From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. At the University of Mississippi, the board refused to renew the contract of a popular and seemingly successful chancellor. And in the United States Senate, Lamar Alexander, chair of the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, signals his priorities for the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act of 1965. Hi, I'm Casey Green, and I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all, and ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We open our conversation this morning looking at the situation at the University of Mississippi and another president who has been dismissed by the board. Last week, the board of the University of Mississippi announced it would not renew the contract for Dan Jones, a popular and by all accounts effective, successful, and well-respected chancellor who has led the Ole Miss campus since 2009. The announcement came as a surprise to both Jones and the Mississippi campus community and seemed, in many ways, to be a replay of events surrounding the recent dismissals or non-renewals of other public university presidents, Teresa Sullivan at the University of Virginia, Bill Powers at the University of Texas, and a succession of recent presidents at the University of Oregon. The board's decision at the University of Mississippi for not renewing the chancellor's contract involves an acknowledged dispute involving the university's medical center. Yet from a broader perspective, the Mississippi action, or rather inaction, coupled with the recent and highly public dismissals of several other public flagship university presidents, raises significant questions about institutional leadership and autonomy and the culture of the boards of these institutions. It also suggests a trend towards more active and perhaps even politicized boards that want to keep campus leaders under tight control and are prepared to dismiss those who disagree with or do not act quickly on board directives. Joining us for the conversation are Peter Eckel, a senior fellow and the director of the leadership programs at the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, by way of background, let me first turn to you. The public account of this at Inside Higher Ed and elsewhere really suggests that it was just one issue that led the board to decide not to renew the contract for the chancellor, Dan Jones, who was, by all accounts, again, effective, successful, and well-respected at the University of Mississippi. Is this really a one-issue decision?
That's certainly the way everyone is describing it. And the one issue, though, a medical center is, of course, a very important part of a university, and at the University of Mississippi and elsewhere, a disproportionate part of the financial picture of the university. But I do think the question is, does any one thing, in this case the medical center, outweigh lots of progress elsewhere? Jones was credited with increasing enrollment, making Black and other minority students feel more welcome, raising academic standards, working well with the faculty. One of the striking things to me about this incident and several of the others you mentioned is at a time that many faculty administration relations are strained, we're seeing presidents and chancellors being ousted at campuses where they get along.
Yeah, that's surprising. Peter, the other interesting thing about this is that Dan Jones knew the medical center. He came from the medical center. He understood the inside workings of the medical center. And yet, again, by Scott's account, by the published accounts, did well as he took the leadership reins of the full campus, and it was just one issue. You've studied boards. How often is a one issue, do these decisions turn on just one issue?
Well, I think the one issue is there's a range of responses for the one issue. You know, in some places, it is a single issue. The board has said this is the priority for the institution. Other times, that one issue becomes a wedge into a much larger conversation. And the third time, it may be a smokescreen. And it's really tough to tell which of those three elements, at least in the short run, which of those three categories is really what's going on. And I don't know the Mississippi story and the background well enough to be able to categorize it in one of those three different elements. But I think the key question that you talked about, the key phrase you put on the table is, by all accounts, effective. And I think we tend to look at, you know, the metrics that Inside Higher Education and other media reports are identifying are very hard, discernible metrics and milestones around elements that we'd all agree are important. But I think actually Bob Birnbaum got it right 25 years ago. He said presidential effectiveness is really much more about stakeholders and constituents. And effectiveness is simply based on how each of the three main constituents, faculty, other administrators, and the board, view the president and view what is supposed to be effective. And clearly, the rules of the board, the rules of the game changed, at least in the board dimension, about how the board defined effectiveness and therefore deemed the president of Mississippi no longer effective.
Peter, let me come back to you on this as well. So we've seen this play out in a couple of states in a couple of different ways. Oregon has gone through a succession, played musical chairs with a couple of presidents in recent years over issues of institutional autonomy. The board dismissed and then rehired the president at the University of Virginia. We've seen tensions at the University of Texas. Some of these presidents seem to be in many ways, again, successful, much like Dan Jones at Mississippi. What do these dismissals reflect about changing board culture, about the political role of the boards, and even the boards as potentially the long arm of the governors, which typically appoint the board members?
Yeah, that's a big question. Let me find what I think is kind of a more narrow way into it. I think we need to think about, you know, how do boards define their own role and what they're supposed to do? And we see some boards who view themselves as an extension of the institution. And so they're part of, you know, the important governance dimensions, and key indicator, key player of the success of the institution or the system. We see other boards who adopt a different framework, which is much more of the outside critic. And are they a representative board, either representing other views, stakeholders, in many cases the public, it's the governor. And that mindset will shape how the board thinks about its work and thinks about how its relationship with that president. Is it a partner or is it a critic?
And Scott, I mean, as you've watched these things and these tensions in a number of states, I mean, the question again becomes, as Peter framed it, you know, where do we see instances where the board is, in fact, an advocate for the university, and in other instances, the board is there as a critic and, in some cases, micromanaging?
Well, the other thing to look at, I think, is board structure. In Mississippi, it's a statewide board overseeing all of the public universities. And so you don't have the same sort of relationship you do at some universities where most board members are truly loyalists and devoted to just one institution. Now, whether that's good or bad is a matter of public policy debate, but I do think it's interesting that in Mississippi it wasn't a institution-specific board, especially since some of the constituents that the chancellor seems to do well with include alumni and big donors. And at a campus where a board is just overseeing one institution, they're likely to pay a lot of attention to big donors who feel strongly connected. So that's just something different about Mississippi than, say, Virginia.
Peter, let me come back to you about the issue of board culture. What defines the culture of a board? Scott alluded to the difference between a board that sits over a single institution as opposed to a state system or a multi-campus system. Board members are typically appointed by the governor. What are the factors that decide and determine the culture of the board?
Yeah, I think there's two issues here. One is the one that Scott put on the table around structure. And I think, you know, there are questions around, do we have a mismatch between the structure of public boards and the complexity of work we're asking boards to do? These boards tend to be small. The average size of the public board, according to the AGB data, is 12. They have frequent meetings, 6 to 9 a year. They tend to be fairly short in time frame, a couple hours. And I think, you know, then you start to look at how do boards spend their time in those meetings and how much work are trustees willing to do between those meetings. So, you know, to what extent is there a mismatch between complexity and the structure and focus of the board? Given all the difficult work and the sheer volume and also the depth and complexity of the issues that boards need to wrestle with. But the other point, I think, is really culture. And the culture will help shape, for example, how much time are boards and how patient are boards in listening to reports in their time, or do they have a much more of an efficiency type of mindset? And I think when you think about board culture, which is we talk a lot about, but we really haven't done a lot of work on, we can think about how do boards behave, how do boards think, What do boards seek, and how do boards define themselves? And I think the answers to these questions create a culture, a mosaic of the culture, for example, that really flavors how boards react, what they prioritize, and how they interact with the president and other key constituents.
And Scott, what about the political context? Again, board members are typically appointed by governors. We've seen, for example, the governor of Wisconsin in a contentious relationship with the university system, and particularly the Madison campus. We've seen the governor in Texas have a similar set of tensions with Bill Powers at the UT Austin campus. To what extent do politics seep into the board culture and as governorships change, as the governors change?
I think they clearly do. I think if you look at the Texas example, it was board members appointed by Governor Perry, not his predecessor or now his successor, that were most critical of UT Austin. If you look at the University of North Carolina system, where a system head is being forced out, you have a more conservative governor than a Democratic predecessor. I'm not sure. Some have been looking for that in Mississippi, but I'm not sure it really applies because you have a conservative Republican who succeeded a conservative Republican. I do think a lot of it, though, is about this issue that Peter was talking about, a board culture. In talking to people in Mississippi, the defenders of the board kept on saying, well, the board identified this issue, and they were upset about this issue, and it didn't change enough. It seems clear, though, that while the board cared about that a lot, and I'm not sure that the political infrastructure of the state cared about a lot, because now there's a lot of talk in the Mississippi legislature about removing the power of the board and giving a new board for each campus.
So looking forward, what does this say about the future relationship of boards and presidents? We've talked about five or six states, essentially 10% of the total, where there have been these kinds of issues in recent years. And yet, because we seem to see more of them, or because they become more visible, it suggests potentially rising risk in some states for the presidents of flagship universities. What are the prospects for the presidents of flagship institutions in other states? Which presidents in what states might be potentially at risk as we look at the landscape? Scott, let me begin with you in terms of, as you scan the landscape, beyond Wisconsin, Texas, Mississippi, what's happened in Oregon, Virginia seems to be settled. Are there other states where we may see this also begin to play out?
There certainly could be, as we've got a lot of governors who seem open to the idea of appointing trustees who may not be gung-ho about the institution. But one of the elements here is a bit of an element of surprise, in part because when board members are maybe feeling dissatisfied on certain issues, the good governance thing would be for them to try to work it out in private. I'd say most people, even if they are on a board and aren't thrilled with a president, would know that a president who is clearly weak vis-a-vis relationship with his or her board is going to have a hard time carrying out an agenda. So the idea of trying to work this out behind the scenes may help presidents improve, but it also may result in more of a surprise when President X, whoever that next president is, appears to be under fire.
And Peter, again, you've done work with AGV. You're now at Penn, where you do a lot of leadership work with institutions. Let me raise the same question with you. Are there states and are there presidents who, given what has played out recently, would seem to be at risk because of these tensions with their boards?
I don't know if I can identify states, but I can talk about some of the data that we collected when I was at AGB about new presidents and how they think about their boards. A new president, I think that you're right in that this is the beginning of what will likely be a rocky road for many. New presidents were much less satisfied, if not downright dissatisfied, than their boards, than more experienced or longer-serving presidents. We saw new presidents were less likely to say boards make a positive impact. We also see new presidents saying that they don't believe they're on the same page about future challenges with the board as longer-serving presidents. So the question that the data suggests is that either are we seeing a new generation of presidents who are thinking differently about boards, maybe more skeptically about boards, or do we see longer-serving presidents who kind of work through a transition stage with their board? And I think we're still very much thinking about what the implications of this are going to be. But we do see some important patterns about newly hired presidents. So it may not be state by state. It may be more of a pattern of chronology. And I think where we see, for example, in Mississippi and other states, that presidents often seem to be, it almost seems that they're caught off guard, even long serving, and by many definitions, successful ones. The question then becomes is, did the culture of the board change fairly rapidly overnight without the president recognizing that the culture is shifting? And I think with smaller boards, with a higher frequency of turnover, just a few board members can change the culture of the board in a much shorter time frame. Different biases, different habits, different blind spots than a private sector board, a private university board.
So, Peter, as we close, and given what you've told us about the attitudes of new presidents towards their board, what counsel would you give to new presidents and those who wish to be new presidents of public flagship universities about board relationships?
Well, I think, first of all, is paying attention to the board. Second of all, it's in ways that you haven't before. So in our study at AGB, 25% of presidents said that they had no board experience or interaction before they became president. They hadn't even staffed a committee. And so really understanding the importance of the board and recognizing that there really is not a honeymoon period with the board. Sure, the board hired you, and so therefore the board thinks that you're their best candidate, and you in turn probably think the board is an effective board as well. But really, how do you be much more intentional about the work of the board? And I think it's understanding that board culture, not just the structure. What are the blind spots the board has? What are the dispositions, either stated or unstated, that set priorities, that dictate behavior, that focus issues such as how the board uses data, about how clear the board is in its own objectives, that I think it's really using that cultural lens to understand boards. What are the values? What are the artifacts? What are the key elements, explicit and implicit, that you need to pay attention to about how boards behave?
Peter Eckel at the University of Pennsylvania and Scott Jasek, thank you for an informative conversation about the challenges that presidents experience and the tensions that may be part of the relationship that presidents and boards at flagship universities have to confront. Thank you both. In our second segment today, we turn to the reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. As chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, Lamar Alexander, a former governor, university president, and the Secretary of Education under President George Bush I, will be the presiding figure in the congressional process to reauthorize the Higher Education Act of 1965. Senator Alexander has signaled his priorities for the Higher Education Act: deregulation, increased accountability, and simplifying the financial aid process. Position papers released by Senator Alexander this week focus on accreditation, having colleges share some of the risk for student loans, and aggregating student data and other aspects of the data collection by the federal government. Senator Alexander has also expressed strong interest in fixing FAFSA, reducing the length and the complexity of the federal financial aid form. Joining us for the conversation are Kevin James, a research fellow who specializes in higher education based at the American Enterprise Institute, and Scott Jasek, the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Kevin James at AEI, let me turn to you first. What are Senator Alexander's priorities, and what's his agenda for reauthorization?
Sure. First, I want to say thanks for having me. I think this is a very timely conversation. And so Senator Alexander has certainly focused on simplification and reducing regulatory burden first and foremost. And so he worked with the American Council on Education, the umbrella group that covers lots of traditional higher education, to really look at the regulatory burden on institutions. He's also, as you mentioned, looked at simplifying FAFSA so that more students can get access to federal aid and aren't deterred from enrolling. But I think more recently we've seen a shift and even a broadening of that agenda to, as you mentioned, include transparency, potential for risk sharing and skin in the game, and then looking at accreditation reform. And I think these things are really trying to get at how the higher education market itself works. So instead of just sort of streamlining how we pay for these things, it's really asking, can we look at ways that we can get more out of the dollars that we invest in these things? Because as you'll see in the documents that they released, I think the committee is saying we invest a lot of money trying to ensure that students get access to education, but are they getting access to something that's of value to them? And I think that's what's really getting, what these documents are getting at.
Scott Jasek, let me turn to you, and let's begin with FAFSA, because this would, in theory, seem to be a relatively easy task. I recall it was 9 years ago in the wake of the Spellings Commission that Margaret Spellings, who also talked about simplifying FAFSA, used a photo op holding the long FAFSA form and said it was her goal to get it down to a page. 9 years have passed, and FAFSA remains about, I believe, 110 or 115 questions. It remains complex. It remains difficult for many families. What's the problem with simplifying FAFSA?
I think everyone seems to agree that it should be simplified. It's much more about how simple. And you have proposals that range from basically two questions to a trimmed down version of what we have now. The problem isn't so much with the student who is very, very low income, but there tends to be concern about those who may have some more resources or who come from families that may not be having large income but have a lot of resources. It's also important to note that many colleges use FAFSA for their own devices, so the issue comes up with institutions that may have more complex goals. But actually, I think of the various things that Alexander's talking about, the center's idea about FAFSA, they should be able to work something out one way or another. I think it's the more, as Kevin was saying, the things that really go to how does the student loan system work, how does the accreditation system work, that's where I think he's really setting off more of a debate.
Let's talk about some of that debate, Kevin, and let's go back to some of your comments as we open. Let's begin with deregulation. There are a couple of different themes in the deregulation paper that was issued by Senator Alexander earlier this week. One, just the burden of regulation across all institutions in terms of forms, data collection. There's a second part of that, which is very much about the experience of for-profit institutions. Sort of help us navigate the different aspects of deregulation and particularly now Senator Alexander's priorities in that domain.
Well, I absolutely think it's important to consider deregulation. I mean, when you look at the range of the amount of regulatory burden that institutions face, it really is quite amazing. And I think there's sometimes a problematic tendency to just sort of assume that more regulation correlates with somehow accomplishing the underlying goals of those original regulations. And I don't think that's always true. I think some of these things are not well thought out. The original problem is no longer a problem. And so I absolutely agree that it's worth taking those on and trying to prune those things back. There's always going to be a difficulty, I think, in that there were underlying things that drove each of these individual regulations. And so I think it comes down to a case-by-case basis as to whether people can really think differently about, is there a better way that we can tackle that problem as opposed to simply just trimming things back entirely. And you see this in some of the pushback. I mean, some groups will say, you know, if we just get rid of this stuff, we're just going to open students up to abuse in certain circumstances. And so I think their ability to be successful is their ability to really look closely at those things and try and tackle the underlying problems in a simpler way.
Scott, let me turn to you about the regulation, deregulation issue. It seems that there's two issues that have flared recently. One is involves Title IX. And how that now falls under the regulatory scope of the federal government has been expanded as the federal government's now looking at issues about sexual violence on campus. And the second, which has been with us for a while, and there's a political divide on this, is the issue of the regulation of for-profit institutions.
Well, the tricky thing there is that one person's excessive regulation is another person's consumer protection or personal protection on case of Title IX. Most people want something to be done about violence on campus. That doesn't mean that the various regulations used to do so are the best way to do so. And similarly, most people want to be assured that student aid isn't going to students at fraudulent or poor-performing institutions, for-profit or non-profit, for that matter. The question is, how do you do so? Senator Alexander has pointed out that regulation has grown over time, which I think is the norm in most parts of society that the federal government interacts with. The question is, how do you pick and choose? NACAC, the Admissions Association, they released a survey of their members, and they were not up in arms about regulation and viewed regulation generally in a positive way as protecting students. Other groups, particularly private colleges and universities, are very much up in arms over regulation.
Let's turn to another topic that was part of the policy papers that released this week, and that's data collection and data privacy. again, the, you know, here as with some of the other papers, there were a couple of different themes. One clear theme in the data paper from the senator's office had to do with the fact that despite the fact that the federal government collects a lot of data, a lot of that data has maybe used more by researchers than by end users, by students and consumers. That would speak to the iPads data, it would speak to the effort about a net cost calculator, some other things. The second has to do with looking at transparency and outcomes. The third, potentially, the issue of, and third very significantly, and we've seen this play out in K-12, the issue of student privacy. If we go to a single federal database that would provide a better way of monitoring students as they migrate from campus to campus and by extension begin to look at the experience, the outcomes, and the loan indebtedness, what's the benefit of that? What are the issues of privacy with that? Kevin, let me turn to you on the data issue first.
Sure. I think all those things are important, but I think it's heartening that Senator Alexander's office is looking at this and asking good questions, because I think, as many have been pointing out recently, including the researchers at the New York Federal Reserve Bank and Sue Donarski recently, a researcher at University of Michigan, the New York Times, we know very little about what goes on with a lot of these things, including the massive student loan portfolio that the federal government holds. And so for example, student privacy is absolutely, first and foremost, the most important thing, but it appears that there are ways that we could take steps to get much more informative data about these things while still protecting student privacy. And furthermore, I think, for example, Senator Alexander's office brought up the idea of a unit record system. I think there's potential in such a system to actually reduce the burden that institutions face while actually improving the sources of data that we have to examine what's going on with the higher education system and to inform students and parents foremost.
Senator Alexander was not the first to talk about student records. We had a public conversation about student records through the last round of reauthorization. Scott, what happened then and what's likely to happen now?
Well, what happened then is that many in higher education opposed the unit record database. So I thought it was very significant that Senator Alexander seems open to that. Why does this matter? If you look at the many colleges, and these days I'd say it's a majority of colleges, that don't just educate students who fit neatly into the traditional federal graduation rate. So they have a lot of transfer students, either in or out. Students may progress to different institutions, and that may be a success for the student, even if they don't have a degree. Tracking all of this, this is hugely important to community colleges, to urban publics, really requires some sort of student unit record database. Private colleges and others have raised all these privacy concerns. You know, when I look at how much data the federal government has on me and everyone, I'm having a hard time viewing that as the most serious privacy concern in America today. But a lot of public policy, I think, that people say they want may depend on a student unit record database.
And Kevin, let's go back to the data that the government collects but is not used. So that falls into a couple of different areas. That, for example, might be the surveys of research capacity done by the National Science Foundation. Potentially it's the library survey or some of the staffing surveys that are part of IPEDS. Is that likely to go, or is that likely to be on the table as part of these conversations led by Senator Alexander and others who are looking at the issue of data not used? And the flip side of that, and a very strong statement in the position paper, was the issue about the data for consumers, that there's a tremendous amount of data that the federal government tries to make available to consumers that's just not used, some of which consumers turn to other sources such as commercial websites.
Yeah, so I do think that there was a very strong emphasis in Senator Alexander's papers that information that was not directly relevant to consumers and parents was not going to be made a priority, and particularly if it posed a significant burden to institutions. And so I think that came through clearly. I'm not sure that that's always totally the right mentality. I think students and parents should be top priority, but I do think that there's also value in providing data to researchers who can provide valuable insights into what's going on. And I'm trying to blank on your second half of your question.
The second
there.
Part was just a lot of the data, the sort of consumer-type data, which...
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
If we look at the evolution of the web, a lot of that, and even before the web, a lot of that came from third-party commercial providers, the college guides, and a lot of that has now migrated to the web. That some of that may be those providers using data that comes from the feds but more traffic on those sites than on federal sites that try to do the same thing or something similar.
Sure, and I think we should learn from other sectors. Actually, I've done a little bit of research recently on healthcare report cards, which are obviously designed to do similar things, and you see similar evidence there that government sources of information are not always trusted in the same way, and I mean sort of consumer-facing sources of information. So one thing we might learn is that the government can actually could play a better role by actually by making this information available, but allowing third-party organizations to present it to consumers in innovative ways that might be more trusted and might be more useful for them.
All right, let's touch on a couple of other issues cited by Senator Alexander. And the first of those is accreditation. Lots of folks are unhappy with accreditation for all kinds of reasons. Kevin, again, back to you. How would Senator Alexander's proposals change accreditation as we know it?
Well, he really looks at two different aspects of it. People raise questions about sort of whether accreditation is doing its job as a quality assurance mechanism. I mean, essentially, accreditation has been the main source of evaluating whether institutions are providing good academic quality to their students, and the Department of Education has played a very hands-off role in that regard. And so that's the first half of the question they're asking is there's good research to suggest that students maybe aren't learning as much as we would hope, and so is accreditation really performing that role? And the second is whether accreditation actually serves as kind of a barrier to sort of innovation and new entrants in the marketplace that might be able to shake up the status quo. So is accreditation really just sort of saying, do you look like a traditional college? And if no, you're not allowed to sort of participate in this? And if so, that's kind of that is a big problem for innovative models that might help students.
Well, Scott, along the lines of innovative models, one of the key roles, historic roles of accreditation is it's the gateway to eligibility for student aid programs. If accreditation loses that gatekeeper role, what happens then for those innovative programs that would like to have their students eligible for financial aid?
Well, first, I want to push back a little on the assumption in the senator's proposal that maybe you need to change accreditation for innovative providers to crop up. Accreditation is definitely a lot of hoops for people to jump through. But if you look at big players today, like Southern New Hampshire University, Western Governors University, everyone who's offering online education, for-profit and non-profit, a lot of competency-based programs, I'm not seeing the evidence that accreditation per se makes it impossible to try significantly different models from what exists. The big problem, and I think in fairness to the senator, I should say that he acknowledges a lot of these issues, is that everyone has their gripes about accreditation, but there's no consensus, I think, on what to do about it so that you preserve the quality, the sort of consumer protection, that you don't have student loans and student aid going to students at disreputable institutions, while encouraging innovation. And while many students haven't a clue who accredits which colleges and what it means, the reality is accreditation by a federally recognized agency is necessary to get student aid. So directly or indirectly, that does become a gatekeeper.
All right, let's talk about the politics of reauthorization. Senator Alexander is a Republican. He was a Republican governor. He served as the Secretary of Education for a Republican president. He has his position as chair because of the Republican majority in the Senate. How political will the reauthorization process be in terms of just in general and specifically for some of the proposals that we hear from Senator Alexander this week, and we'll hear from others in the coming weeks? Kevin, let's talk to you first about the political process.
Sure. I think the proposals have a lot of merit, and they'll have support from people on sort of all sides of the political spectrum, I think, within sort of the research community and the think tank community. And so I think there's potential for gains there, but I do think the process can easily become politicized because the devil's in the details with a lot of this stuff. And there's a lot of, as you know, heightened awareness around issues of student debt and the cost of higher education. And so I think the potential for the process to become very contentious over how these things actually look in legislative texts, I think the chances of that are very high.
So, Scott, let me push you on that. Kevin has said there's the potential for contention. deregulation of for-profits will no doubt be a consensus issue. Some issues about financial aid, if colleges, for example, are asked to assume some burden or some responsibility for default rates that they currently don't assume. Where are the points of contention that we may see as that will flare up through the reauthorization process?
Well, I think you have to look at the broader political context. In reading the Senator Alexander's various proposals, whether one agrees with him or not, it struck me that he was framing issues as these are difficult issues and some possible ways of dealing with them. And he also noted in many cases some of the concerns about some of the solutions. So I didn't view his set of proposals as a we must do this. There were, frankly, you know, the tone was one of inviting conversation and interaction, which could point to a meaningful reauthorization process. But you have to look at what's the state of Washington right now, and it is hard for me to imagine that any legislation, higher ed or otherwise, isn't going to get really caught up in the rather bitter partisanship we have right now. And certainly on issues like for-profit higher education, where many Republicans have sort of gone to bat for that and attacked Obama, I think there are enough things here that are likely to turn into an us versus them debate that it's going to be hard to carry out the tone of the senator's proposals.
Well, let's hope that his tone prevails over the conversation as opposed to politics casting a dark shadow over it. Kevin James from the American Enterprise Institute, Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, thank you for the informative and engaging conversation about reauthorization. Our thanks as well to Peter Eccles, Senior Fellow at the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania, for the conversation about tensions that may exist between boards and presidents of public flagship universities. This Week at Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or a podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we're available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you for joining us.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.